State, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Jack Andrea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911. They may be closed, but they have not lost their hometown spirit. You can visit jackandrea.com to shop their exclusive hometown collection, including Kenosha t-shirts, sweatshirts, and mugs. jackandrea.com. Morning Show with Greg Berg is next. I am very excited on today's morning show to be reconnecting with an outstanding writer by the name of Larry Tye, with whom I spoke about a very illuminating book called Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon. Larry Tye has a host of other fascinating books to his credit, including Satchel, The Life and Times of an American Legend, and a book that I bought just for the fun of it called Superman, The High-Flying History of America's Most Enduring Hero. His latest book is extraordinary. It is titled Demagogue, The Life and Long Shadow of Senator Joe McCarthy. In this scrupulously researched book and beautifully written book, Larry Tye examines the life of the infamous Joe McCarthy and brings to light all kinds of new information about McCarthy, which has only recently come to light. And it helps shape an even more revelatory picture of who Joe McCarthy was, how he operated, particularly behind closed doors, what was at the heart of his often ruthless search for communists supposedly infiltrating the United States government in the early 1950s. And his book is also a riveting account of Joe McCarthy's downfall. The book is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. The book, again titled Demagogue, The Life and Long Shadow of Senator Joe McCarthy. Larry Tye, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Great to be back on with you.
One of the things that I think is important for us to know is that your book, as I touched on, is fascinating in part because of certain materials that have become available and have never really been thoroughly examined before. Explain to our listeners the kind of information that has been released or brought to light or made available to you that makes this, in a sense, a book about Joe McCarthy like none that has come before it.
So you're very polite. And what I think the another way of phrasing that same question would be, why the heck do we need another biography, given all the ones out there, and is there anything new you have to say? And what biographers have been waiting for nearly three quarters of a century is a look at the personal and professional papers, the box after box of personal and professional papers that McCarthy's widow left to his alma mater, Marquette University, shortly after the senator died and shortly before she died. And those papers have been gathering dust. And there are archivists there who I'm convinced were convinced that they would die without ever anybody ever getting to look at those papers but them, because they were the stipulation when the papers were donated is they would only become public when the family said they would become public. And for all those years, they've been saying no. And I was lucky enough for them to decide when I was writing my book to say yes to me. And what that meant was a yes to seeing everything from the senator's love letters to his wife, to his soon-to-be wife, to seeing his office records, to getting an unvarnished look at all the things that were deposited there. And as you know, when people are leaving behind their papers, it's often done post-mortem when nobody has the energy to really look through and scour and say, we're only going to leave things that make somebody look good. So they really are look at things that make him look better than he might have and things that make him look worse and give us a more complete picture of who he was. And those are the papers that were left to Marquette. There were stacks of other papers. There were all of his medical records at Bethesda Naval Hospital, which were records of where he was treated nearly nonstop from the time he came in as a senator in 1946 to the time he died 11 years later in 1957. And generally, those are the kinds of things that never see the light of day. And I had been asking them for so long that I assumed there was no prayer of them ever being turned over to me. And one day, early in the morning, my wife and I were taking our dog for a walk pre-dawn, and she said, what's that big box at the head of our driveway? And I said, whatever it is, it can wait. Let's go for our walk. And she said, no, it could rain. We've got to check out what that is. And what that was all of his records from Bethesda Naval Hospital. Somebody, probably a mid-level official there, decided that after all these years, those papers ought to be turned over to somebody. And those, again, gave a very different sense, not just of the kinds of illnesses the senator had suffered from, but it gave the lie to the fact that he had died from acute hepatitis. And the papers showed something quite different. And the last two stashes of papers were his military records, which the Marines had given to the public in dribs and drabs over the years, but there were lots of records that had never been released, and those were made available. And not long before I started working on this book, all of the hearings that McCarthy had held, your listeners who know anything about McCarthy's history may remember the famous Army McCarthy hearings, but all of the public hearings like that, where the public really got to see what Joe McCarthy was like, made up just one-third of the hearings that the senator held. The other two-thirds were behind closed doors, had never been seen, and those papers were made available by the Senate historian. As I say, not long before I started writing the book, there were 9,000 pages of transcripts. Nobody had ever done a deep dive into those things. The Senate historian was an old pal who told me I ought to do a deep dive into them. And again, they are Joe McCarthy unhinged. So when you add up all those things, the Marquette records, the military and medical files, the closed-door hearings, if I couldn't write a good book based on all of that, then shame on me.
One of the things that you are careful to say in the book's preface is this: I seek not to redeem the Wisconsin senator, but rather to unmask fanatics and fabricators on all sides in a way that presents a truer, more fully dimensional portrait of a figure so central to the narrative of America. As we read on further into that paragraph, it becomes really clear what you're talking about there. Explain to our listeners, in a sense, the sort of damage you have had to sort of undo in order for a more authentic portrait of Joe McCarthy to emerge?
So it is partly looking at Joe McCarthy not as a single historical figure. No matter how interesting anybody is to American history, whether it is Bobby Kennedy or Satchel Paige, whether it's Superman or Joe McCarthy, we are often interested in biography not just to look at that individual, but to look at them as a lens into a bigger issue. And the bigger issue in this case is the one-word title of my book, and it's the word demagogue. Joe McCarthy was not the first American demagogue to arise in a uniquely all-American way. He was one. He followed people like Huey Long and like the infamous Senator Theodore Bilbo. There were a whole host of American demagogues throughout our history, and Joe McCarthy happened to be what I think is the archetypal demagogue, the one who set the model for those who came after. But he was the latest in this line of demagogues that came before him. He was the first in a line of demagogues that came after him and keep coming. So it was partly trying to unlock a more complete picture of who he was, but as important, it was trying to give us a better sense of the playbook that demagogues used of his up until this day.
We're speaking with Larry Tye, author of a brand new book called Demagogue, The Life and Long Shadow of Senator Joe McCarthy. The first line of the preface is, this is a book about America's love affair with bullies. And you say later, but this is more than a biography of a single bully, but about the American strain of demagoguery that has been part of our history since its founding days. Without going into any specifics about any of the particular demagogues that you do at least mention and examine, I wonder if you could just maybe say a word about what you think is going on in America and in our history right to this present day, that this is, in a sense, part of who we are. Where do you think this is coming from, or to what can we attribute this? Or have demagogues emerged for widely different reasons over the course of our history?
So I think they have emerged because of widely different reasons in terms of what was going on in that moment of history, but I think there are common elements that define all these demagogues, and it is in a time of turmoil, and we are, like any country in the world, perpetually going through turmoil. We are looking for easy and facile answers that let us see the cause of our problem. We are looking for scapegoats that let us blame our problem on people other than us as being a root cause of things. We are looking for ways at blaming the media, who give us a sense of what's going on around us and give us maybe more sophisticated or less popular answers for why things are going wrong. All of those kinds of elements, all the tendency to want to blame, to want to simplify, to want to offer some rousing sense of how we can get out of our doldrums, all of those are temptations for countries all around the world. And we're very good in America in analyzing other countries' problems with this, whether it was what led Nazi Germany to turn to Hitler, or what led fascist Italy to turn to Mussolini, or what leads Russia today to turn to an ultimate demagogue like Vladimir Putin. But we generally don't acknowledge that we've got as deep a strain of demagoguery as anywhere in the world, and a consistent one, and that it is only by understanding that strain of demagoguery that we're going to get beyond it. And the way to understand it, I think, one really important way to understand it, is to look at the king of all demagogues, who is your very own Wisconsin Senator Joe McCarthy.
Right. I want to get to the Wisconsin connection in just a moment. I want to just circle back for a second to one other line in the preface as you are talking about this. And as you make mention of our current president, Donald Trump, whom some characterize as a demagogue. Of course, his supporters would not. But you write, the truth is that Trump is the latest in a bipartisan queue of fanatics and hate peddlers who have tapped into America's deepest insecurities. I think that is such an intriguing point, just worth talking about for a moment, because I don't think many of us stop to think about what America's deepest insecurities might be and how those might drive certain political movements and incidents in our history.
Sure. So let's talk about the insecurities around Joe McCarthy that made America so ripe at that moment for somebody like him to come along. The insecurities were understandable. We were in the most hot phase of the Cold War with the Soviet Union and with the communist world. We had watched everything from the spy Fuchs be exposed in England. He's the guy who, along with the Rosenbergs, gave away atomic secrets. We were watching Red China become Red China as the nationalists were defeated and as Mao Zedong and his forces took over. We were in such a period of fright that children would be shortly taught to duck under their desks in the event of a nuclear attack, and they would be trained in classrooms to go do those kinds of things. And I think we were in a very real insecurity vis-a-vis our communist adversaries in the Cold War. But what happened with that insecurity is it seeped into our thinking enough that we tended again to turn to facile answers, to easy answers as to the cause of the insecurity. The threat from the Soviet Union was very real. The threat from internal spies had at an earlier point in our history been something that was real. But by the time Joe McCarthy came along, most of the 24-carat spies, the easy ones to get, had been exposed. And so he used old, outdated lists. He pointed fingers at targets who weren't legitimate targets. And I think that most serious anti-communists of his era would say he did more damage to their movement than he did help it. And I think that that was the kind of danger. He played on our insecurities to give us answers that weren't real ones and ended up undermining the very values that he said he was out there promoting.
Hmm. You do say, as the preface concludes, I have tried to judge McCarthy by the standard of his tense times rather than by more recent insights about just how wobbly the Soviet Empire was. And to give the senator the benefit of the doubt he seldom gave his victims, while I focus on the decade of McCarthy's life in Washington, I return repeatedly to his bedrock origins in Wisconsin for a deeper understanding, only by examining the nuances of his pilgrimage can we pare away the historical fictions and see this unorthodox political figure as human and plausible. What are some of the most important nuances of his pilgrimage from his origins in Wisconsin that are most important for us to know?
So I don't want to pretend to preach to Wisconsinites about your political history. Most of your listeners probably know it a whole lot better than I do. But I see Wisconsin as having two strains in its politics historically and today. Among the most progressive states in America that gave us a party called the Progressive Party with the La Follettes, a father and son team of senators and a governor, and having some of the most conservative politics in America over the years with Joe McCarthy and others. Joe McCarthy was both. He tapped into, in a way that very few politicians could ever have tried to do or pulled off as effectively as Joe McCarthy did. And I don't know whether most of your listeners are aware that Joe McCarthy began life as a flaming New Deal liberal, a fan of FDR, as a guy who went out and gave speeches in favor of the New Deal, and a guy who ran for his first office, an unsuccessful race for district attorney as a Democrat. He saw quickly that in the part of Wisconsin he came from, the area around Appleton, that he was not going to get elected as a Democrat, and certainly not as a flaming New Deal Democrat. So quietly, he changed parties to the Republican Party, but not just the Republican Party writ large. The most conservative wing, called stalwart Republicans, and he became their standard bearer when he ran for Senate. And he was enough of a, either you could say enough of a creative and flexible-minded guy, or enough of a flip-flopper and an opportunist to be willing to do whatever it took to get the office that he wanted. And that meant switching ideologies, it meant switching parties, and it meant masterfully understanding the different strains of politics in Wisconsin and creating a whole new strain of his own, which was McCarthyism.
I wonder if we could spend just a moment talking about one interesting and complicated chapter in his life, and that is his military service and the way in which this was viewed rather skeptically by some, particularly by his fiercest critics. And in some ways, those critics, it appears, went too far in the way they characterized, or maybe mischaracterized, whether or not Joe McCarthy had in fact served his country in good faith as a member of the military, or whether he was merely an opportunist who had, in a sense, fabricated some of what he had experienced and achieved. Can you offer a bit of clarification to this this complicated moment in the McCarthy story?
Yes. So Joe McCarthy, when he first ran for office, characterized himself as Tail Gunner Joe. He had served in the South Pacific in the Marine Corps during World War II, and he said he had been a fearless tail gunner flying combat missions over these dangerous South Pacific islands. And it worked when he first ran for office and people bought it. But very quickly, the press started looking into what he'd done and started becoming very skeptical. And by the end, the moniker Tail Gunner Joe became a caricature. CBS did a national documentary on McCarthy that they called Tail Gunner Joe, and it was a documentary making fun of him as a liar. And they said, the same way many media in Wisconsin had said, that McCarthy had embellished his military record. And it wasn't surprising they would say that, because he had embellished so much else in his life that it was easy to believe he was a liar. I wrote one of my books on a man who was the so-called father of public relations, a man named Edward Bernays, and I called the book The Father of Spin. And I think there was nobody who was a better spinmeister out there than Joe McCarthy. But what his records at Marquette showed, and this is where, in the beginning of our conversation, I said some of the things in these hidden files made him look worse than he was, and others made him look better. And one of the things that made him look better was his actual handwritten diaries that nobody had ever seen, that were diaries that he kept while he was fighting in the South Pacific. And those diaries, along with letters of his comrades in arms in the Marine Corps, make clear that while his official mission during World War II was as a land-based intelligence agent, in fact, he volunteered to go on missions as a tail gunner. He went up under enemy fire, and he put himself at risk. You don't go up, unless you're a real crazy guy, you don't go up there just to get the press being able to say you're a tail gunner. You are putting yourself at risk of dying every time you're up there in the back of that plane because you believe in the mission. And his fellow soldiers there testified in letter after letter that he believed in what he was doing, and he wanted to be up there at the same risk that they were, not at his safe land-based job. And so here's an area, a critical part of his biography, that not only wasn't he lying about, but his defenses, which were never believed, were credible, which raises a whole different question, which is why, if he had the evidence the way he did with his diaries and his letters from his mates, why he hadn't done a better job in getting that evidence out there, and why he had let so much of it gather dust over three quarters of a century in his files, and we will never know the definitive answer to that. But I think, and maybe this is giving him too much credit, I think that Joe McCarthy actually had at this one point in his life enough humility that he thought, if people aren't believing me about something where I was putting my life at risk every day, then I'm not going to stoop to having to show them my personal diaries and these letters. And I think that he may have actually believed that people should believe him, and if they didn't, too bad for them.
I do want to ask you about one other thing in this chapter called Coming Alive, where you discuss his experience in the military and some other controversies that surrounded that. You tell us at one point what would become McCarthy's trademark antipathy toward the military brass was born during his own armed service. This is the kind of story that we often don't hear very much about. Explain what those issues were and how they became significant later on in McCarthy's political career.
So Joe McCarthy was a very famous and colorful name caller, and in his diary, he referred to the military brass with names like mental midgets and morons, and those are the kinds of names he ended up using over the years with most of his enemies. And he was not upset with his fellow grunts in the military. It was the generals and the people who were doing things he felt like not giving the soldiers enough good, healthy food that they needed, who were watching one branch of the military compete with another branch of the military that was putting at risk the soldiers who were out there fighting. And I think some of his complaints were legitimate. Most of his complaints were embellished. And how he would have known as a tail gunner, as a ground-based, you know, small intelligence operator, how he would have known what the truly high-up brass were thinking and doing, it was well beyond his pay grade and beyond anything that he could truly see. And I think it was just his way of striking out against authority, which was a common theme throughout his life. Blame the brass, blame the president, blame the State Department, blame whomever. And it was just the idea of striking out and wanting to blame somebody is a natural instinct. The idea of doing it as often as Joe McCarthy did with as little evidence as he typically would have was an unfortunate instinct.
We're speaking with Larry Tye about his new book, Demagogue, The Life and Long Shadow of Senator Joe McCarthy. Let's talk about the beginning of McCarthy's career in the U.S. Senate. And you chronicle, I don't think we really need to talk about it here, but you chronicle his path to victory and certainly all of the early campaigns that he waged, including the ultimately successful campaign that made him a U.S. senator, bear all the hallmarks of what we think of with Joe McCarthy and his tactics. Explain to our listeners a bit about what the very beginning of his first term as a U.S. senator were like, and the way in which he very much broke the mold in terms of how a freshman senator would comport themselves.
So on the one hand, he went in guns blazing from moment one. He went in making charges before he had really even taken his been sworn into the Senate, making charges against there was a major strike going on in the country then, and he talked about shooting people if they were doing what he felt was traitorous action in terms of a strike that would threaten the country's stability. He went in the taking up causes of industry groups like the housing industry that was trying to build new housing for returning veterans. Instead of representing his fellow veterans, he was much more interested, it seemed, in representing high-paying housing developers. And he went in taking on issues that made him become dubbed the Coca-Cola Kid when he took on the interests of the soft drink industry at a time of sugar rationing. He went in essentially as a senator who looked like he was going to have a totally unexceptional career, was not going to make a name for himself other than as a toady to big corporate interests, and as somebody who probably wouldn't get reelected. And that's the way it looked for a good half of his first term.
At one point, you write, a consensus was building. His career as a senator was more than just undistinguished. It was a train wreck. Even his fellow Republicans saw him as a gas bag and a pretender. I mean, that would seem to indicate that the political career of Joe McCarthy was not going to last very long at all. But you write then, Joe thirsted for a new cause that could salvage his career. And of course, we can all guess what that cause was.
So we can guess what it was, and yet until the very last minute, it was uncertain what it was going to be. He was invited to Wheeling, as his staff called it, Wheeling, West by God, Virginia, which was about as out of the way burg as you could find, to deliver a famous Lincoln Day dinner speech. On the anniversary of Abe Lincoln's birth, the Republicans all across the country would have dinners to try to raise money and to try to promote up-and-coming figures in the party. And McCarthy was enough of an undistinguished figure that the only place that he was invited was to go to West Virginia. He showed up at that speech with a briefcase that contained two speeches. One was a snoozer of a speech on national housing policy, which was an issue that he actually knew something about. The other was a barn burner of a speech on communism and on communist infiltration of the U.S. government, which was a topic that he knew almost nothing about. And it wasn't until he actually got there that he decided which of the speeches to pull out of his bag and deliver that night. Had he delivered the first speech on housing policy, we wouldn't be having this conversation today, and he would have been a one-term, easily forgettable senator. But instead, he delivered the other speech. Within a day or two, he was on the front page of every newspaper in America, and Joe McCarthy was born, and McCarthyism was given its birth.
Mm. There are a couple things about the way you describe this that I think are important to talk about. First of all, you say, and you've touched on this already, Joe McCarthy arguably was less well-versed in foreign policy and Russian statecraft than anyone in the U.S. Senate in 1950. I mean, that's a really important statement right there. But you go on to say, but nobody was better at reading America's pent-up fears and feeding them. And what a dangerous combination that is when you understand the pent-up fears of the average middle American, and you have this innate ability to feed those fears. He had both of those capabilities.
He did. And one of the things that he realized in delivering that speech in West Virginia was lots of people had been pointing the finger at the Soviet Union and saying, you know, they may have spies here, and we really have to be worried not just about what's going on overseas, but what's going on behind every pillar on our own government institutions. But very few leaders at that time had the chutzpah to name the traitors and point fingers at specific individuals. And McCarthy knew there was nothing better, if you want to truly rile up the public, than to stand there and say, as you wave the piece of paper, say, I've got in my hand a list of 205 traitors who are really undermining the security of our government. And of course, every journalist in the world wanted to know what those names were. They wanted to print the names. They wanted to know from President Truman how he could allow people to exist in his government who were known security risks. And Joe McCarthy was off and running. And he was off and running in a way that he always stayed at least two steps ahead of the journalists and of his adversaries, because every time they would shoot down one name, he'd have two more the next day for people to print. And retractions in newspapers and corrections always get smaller print than the next day's big headline story of the new spy in town.
And of course, as we've already said, Joe McCarthy had the issue he needed to snatch the limelight he craved. And I think it's really interesting when you talk about this matter of him having specific names and, you know, brandishing a piece of paper that supposedly had a long list of many names of suspected communists, that he was doing something new in this crusade, which did not actually begin with him, but which he, in a sense, perfected. You write, this time he grasped something earlier treason shouters had not, that counting and naming the actual traitors had a frontier justice allure. This changed the game, in a sense.
It did. Joe McCarthy was, he may have come from solid Midwestern stock, but he was a cowboy, and he understood that justice allure, and he understood that waving paper, counting supposed subversives, naming names, whether or not those names could be substantiated, his charges substantiated, that it worked. The press loved it, the public ate it up, and he soared from this backbencher who looked like he was on his way to electoral defeat to a senator who won an easy reelection and who became a national figure.
By the way, right after this first speech is given, you tell us about a very, very angry response to it penned by then-President Harry S. Truman. And here are the words. This is the first time in my experience, and I was 10 years in the Senate, that I ever heard of a senator trying to discredit his own government before the world. I am very sure that the people of Wisconsin are extremely sorry that they are represented by a person who has as little sense of responsibility as you have. You go on to say that note was never sent. First of all, how do we even know about that note if it was never sent? And help us understand why Truman refrained from sending it.
So I think we know about that note because Truman wanted us to know about it and regretted never having sent it. And so historians had easy access to it. But I think that it was never sent because more sober-minded people than our wonderfully fiery President Harry Truman said, if you give McCarthy the podium by having the president come out and take seriously enough what he did to attack him in that way, it will encourage this demagogue. That's exactly the kind of fervor that demagogues feed off, or the kind of national attention that they want. And on the one hand, Truman was right in everything he said except the wisdom of the people of Wisconsin and whether or not they would reelect him. But he was right that McCarthy was endangering American security more than he was protecting it the way he pretended to do. And the idea that he was bringing down and calling into question his own government was only a good thing if he could prove that that was a way of making the government stronger. And instead, he just undermined it, and he made it so that people didn't want to do government service. And it became an embarrassment for a time to work in the State Department, because Joe McCarthy said the State Department had a spy behind every pillar. And I think Harry Truman's instincts were right, and his advisors who restrained him were right in the same way that being right doesn't give you ammunition necessarily to take on a demagogue.
You also mention in this portion of this book, of this chapter called An Ism Is Born, that that it is not a surprise that this incendiary speech was not given in Washington, D.C., but someplace else, and that this was a pattern with McCarthy during this time. You call it a perk of the backwater, that Joe McCarthy would be very careful about where he would make certain announcements for certain kinds of reporters.
Yes, and so the kinds of reporters, the perk of the backwater was, if you make incendiary charges about what's going on at the State Department in a place where reporters have covered the State Department and would know who to call for a quick comment, would know what the record was of digging up spies at the State Department, and who could, in that same day's story, respond on deadline in a thoughtful way, that was dangerous. You didn't want to do it in front of those kinds of reporters. You wanted to do it in the people who were covering a speech in Wheeling, West Virginia, a local newspaper that had no reason to ever write anything about the State Department except when Joe McCarthy came to town telling them about what was going on there. So you wanted to do it in a way that today, in our world of instant media and of global coverage, it would be easy to get the right reporters there responding immediately. In those days, it was the reporters out in the backwater who covered all of his early charges, and by the time he ended up back in Washington, his movement had been born, and it was too late to really rebut the things that he had said and that might have been rebutted had he said them to a Washington press corps instead of a rural America press corps.
Right. Another facet of this story, which I did not understand until I read your book, is that, on the other hand, Joe McCarthy desperately needed the Washington press when, in a sense, it came time to move beyond vague hyperbole and supply actual names. I mean, and this is where suddenly he had to try to produce something which he, in fact, at that point in time, did not have specifics of specific people guilty of specific things. And he actually had to turn, among other things, to the press for assistance.
He did. So an effective demagogue knows how to charm the press when that is useful and how to attack them when that's the only option. And Joe McCarthy did both in a way that set a playbook. He worked with reporters. Two of the leading investigative columnists in America at that time are sort of a wonderful litmus test for what Joe McCarthy did. And they were a columnist, the most widely read columnist in America, Drew Pearson, and his young sidekick, who became the most widely known investigative columnist in later years, Jack Anderson. And at the beginning, Joe McCarthy courted them. He would let them listen in to phone conversations he was having with senior government officials. He fed them stories that they loved. You know, instead of the next day's charge on who was a communist going to everybody, he would feed it to a columnist like Drew Pearson and give him an exclusive. And in the early days, Pearson and Anderson used Joe McCarthy as one of their best sources. But as they increasingly saw that the information he had didn't stand up over time, they became increasingly skeptical, and instead of courting them, he went after them. He attacked Drew Pearson viciously on the Senate floor. He nearly beat him up at a session where they were both at a fancy social club in Washington, and Jack Anderson ended up hating McCarthy enough that he wrote the first critical biography ever written on Joe McCarthy.
You tell us that the Democrats in the Senate perhaps made a miscalculation in what would amount to kind of their first face-to-face confrontation with him, choosing to go toe-to-toe with him and, in your words, helping make him a martyr. And let's be clear, this is years before McCarthy's downfall. This is actually before his rise to his highest prominence. What was this kind of mistaken strategy of the Democrats at this crucial moment?
So the strategy was exactly what we were talking about with President Truman a bit earlier. It was confronting McCarthy with the names that he was raising and asking about each one and trying to show that people's earlier, maybe college-era flirtations with left-wing politics didn't mean that they were a communist, showing that a lot of the people who was pointing to as spies at the State Department didn't really work for the State Department ever or anymore. It was sort of taking name by name and trying to repudiate McCarthy's supposed evidence on those individuals. But every time they did, he would be jumping ahead with another name, or he would be calling their patriotism into question. It was, if you were somebody as verbally skillful as Joe McCarthy, he was like the brilliant trial lawyer who you could never pin down. And over time, they were the ones who ended up having the fingers pointed at them rather than them effectively being able to take down Joe McCarthy. And when he didn't win with them in a hearing room, he would take them on electorally. The senator who went after him the hardest was a senator, a patrician senator from Maryland named Millard Tidings. And he was the one who Democrats had named to chair a subcommittee that was going after Joe McCarthy. He was the one who wrote a damning report calling McCarthy the fraud that he was. And he was the one who saw a know-nothing Republican financed by and armed by Joe McCarthy take on the Senator Tidings, who looked like he was unbeatable, and beat him at the polls. And when Joe McCarthy brought down Millard Tidings, it sent a message to every enemy or every potential enemy that McCarthy had in the Senate: you take me on at your own risk, beware my battering ram. And his battering ram proved incredibly effective.
I'm so glad that you take a moment in your book to acknowledge the only Republican who took a firm stand against McCarthy at this point, the Senate's only woman, Margaret Chase Smith. We've already talked about the fact that one of the most enlightening discoveries you were able to make was to probe the nature of the closed hearings behind closed doors, in which we see a very different Joe McCarthy from that seen in the open sessions, many of which were televised. You call these closed doors hearings a grand inquisitor's dream. But I think we'll leave it to our listeners to explore that and instead give you an opportunity to talk about how all of this comes apart for Joe McCarthy. This rapid rise to enormous prominence comes crashing down. And for reasons that are beyond the obvious and reasons beyond what we assume to be the most important.
Yes. So if we want to focus on his downfall, we should start out at the beginning of 1954, when Joe McCarthy had been taking on the U.S. military. He charged that at a base in New Jersey called Fort Monmouth, that it was a place where Julius Rosenberg, the famous atomic spy, had left behind a nest of his fellow spies, and McCarthy was going to root them out. And he started out that year, 1954, as the second most popular politician in America. A full 50% of the American public, the Gallup polls told us, thought Joe McCarthy was just swell. And the only politician who was more popular then was the President Dwight Eisenhower. But McCarthy was taking on America's mighty military machine. And that was an operation that wasn't going to be easily pushed around. That was an operation that arose, that finally got President Eisenhower angry enough at McCarthy that he was going to stand up to him. And in the famous Army McCarthy hearings, where his fellow senators called him before a committee of inquisition and the Army, we saw Joe McCarthy at his bullying best. And by the end of those hearings, when McCarthy had appeared on television screens in every living room in America, and these were the most watched hearings, one of the most watched sets of hearings in the history of the American Congress, those hearings were Joe McCarthy's downfall. It became clear that his charges against the Army were partly trumped up. It became clear that he was like a barroom or a backstreet bully, and it became clear that America had invested much too much faith in him. He starts out that year at 50%. He ends up by that summer at the end of the Army McCarthy hearings in the mid-30s. He had watched his popularity plummet. He was finally at a point where the president and where his fellow senators could effectively take him on. At the end of the McCarthy hearings, he was wounded. By the end of 1954, he was a political basket case. His fellow senators, in a very unusual action, had publicly condemned him, had said that he was a bully, and by the end of 1954, while Joe McCarthy would live for another 2.5 years, and while he would continue serving in the U.S. Senate, he was essentially a political corpse.
Mm. And